Macmillan Audio presents Silke's Journey by Heather Morris. Read for you by Louise Brealey.
To my grandchildren, Henry, Nathan, Jack, Rachel, and Ashton. Never forget the courage, the love, the hope given to us by those who survived and those that did not. This is a work of fiction based on what I learnt from the first-hand testimony of Lale Sokolov, the tattooist of Auschwitz, about Cecilia Silke Klein, whom he knew in Auschwitz-Birkenau, from the testimony of others who knew her, and from my own research. Although it weaves together facts and reportage with the experiences of women survivors of the Holocaust and the experiences of women sent to the Soviet Gulag system at the end of the Second World War, it is a novel and does not represent the entire facts of Silke's life. Furthermore, it contains a mix of characters, some inspired by real-life figures, in some instances representing more than one individual, others completely imagined. There are many factual accounts that document these terrible epochs in our history, and I would encourage the interested listener to seek them out. For more information about Cecilia Klein and her family, and about the gulags, please keep listening after the end of the audiobook. I hope that further details about Silke and those who knew her will continue to come to light once the book is published. Heather Morris, October 2019. Chapter 1. Auschwitz Concentration Camp, 27th of January, 1945. Silke stares at the soldier standing in front of her, part of the army that has entered the camp. He is saying something in Russian, then German. The soldier towers over the 18-year-old girl. Du bist frei. You are free. She does not know if she has really heard his words. The only Russians she has seen before this in the camp were emaciated, starving, prisoners of war. Could it really be possible that freedom exists? Could this nightmare be over? When she does not respond, he bends down and places his hands on her shoulders. She flinches. He quickly withdraws his hands.
Sorry, I didn't mean to scare you, he continues in halting German.
Shaking his head, he seems to conclude she doesn't understand him. He makes a sweeping gesture and slowly says the words again. You are free. You are safe. We are the Soviet army and we are here to help you. I understand, Silke whispers, pulling tight the coat that hides her tiny frame. Do you understand Russian? Silke nods yes. She grew up knowing an East Slavic dialect, Rusyn. What's your name? He asks gently. Silke looks up into the soldier's eyes and says in a clear voice, My name is Cecilia Klein, but my friends call me Silke. That's a beautiful name, he says. It is strange to be looking at a man who is not one of her captors and is so healthy. His clear eyes, his full cheeks, his fair hair protruding from beneath his cap. Where are you from, Silke Klein? Memories of her old life have faded, become blurred. At some point it became too painful to remember that her former life with her family in Bardejov existed. I'm from Czechoslovakia, she says in a broken voice. Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp, February 1945. Silke has been sitting in the block, as close as she can get to the one stove that provides heat. She knows she has already drawn attention. The other able-bodied women, her friends included, were forcibly marched out of the camp by the SS weeks ago. The remaining prisoners are skeletal, diseased, or they are children. And then there is Silke, They were all meant to be shot, but in their haste to get away themselves, the Nazis abandoned them all to fate. The soldiers have been joined by other officials, counterintelligence agents, Silkra's heard, though she's not sure what that means, to manage a situation the average soldier has no training for. The Soviet agency is tasked with keeping law and order, particularly as it relates to any threat to the Soviet state. Their role, she's been told by the soldiers, is to question every prisoner, to determine their status as it relates to their imprisonment, in particular if they collaborated or worked with the Nazis. The retreating German army are considered enemies of the state of the Soviet Union, and anyone who could be connected to them is, by default, an enemy of the Soviet Union. A soldier enters the block. "Come with me," he says, pointing to Silke. At the same time, a hand clutches her right arm, dragging her to her feet. Several weeks have passed, and seeing others being taken away to be questioned has become part of the routine of the block. To Silke, it is just her turn. She is 18 years old, and she just has to hope they can see that she had no choice but to do what she did in order to survive. No choice other than death. She can only hope that she will soon be able to return to her home in Czechoslovakia, find a way forward. As she's taken into the building the Soviet army are using as their headquarters, Silke attempts a smile at the four men who sit across the room from her. They are here to punish her evil captors, not her. This is a good time. There will be no more loss. Her smile is not returned. She notices their uniforms are slightly different to those of the soldiers outside. Blue epaulettes sit on top of their shoulders. Their hats, placed on the table in front of them, have the same shade of blue ribbon with a red stripe. One of them does eventually smile at her and speaks in a gentle voice. "Would you tell us your name?"
"Cecilia Klein."
"Where are you from, Cecilia? Your country and town?"
"I'm from Bardejov in Czechoslovakia."
"What is the date of your birth?"
"The 17th of March, 1926.
"How long have you been here?"
"I came here on the 23rd of April in 1942, just after I turned 16.
The agent pauses, studies her. "That was a long time ago."
"An eternity in here."
"What have you been doing here since April 1942?
"Staying alive."
"Yes, but how did you do that?" He tilts his head at her. "You look like you haven't starved."
Silke doesn't answer, but her hand goes to her hair, which she hacked off herself weeks ago after her friends were marched from the camp.
"Did you work?"
"I worked at staying alive."
The four men exchange looks. One of them picks up a piece of paper and pretends to read it before speaking.
"We have a report on you, Cecilia Klein. It says that you in fact stayed alive by prostituting yourself to the enemy."
Silke says nothing, swallows hard, looks from one man to the next, trying to fathom what they are saying, what they expect her to say in return. Another speaks. "It's a simple question. Did you fuck the Nazis?"
"They were my enemy. I was a prisoner here."
"But did you fuck the Nazis? We're told you did."
"Like many others here, I was forced to do whatever I was told by those who imprisoned me."
The first agent stands. "Cecilia Klein, we will be sending you to Krakow and then determining your fate from there." He refuses now to look at her.
"No," Silke says, standing.
"This can't be happening.
You can't do this to me. I am a prisoner here."
One of the men who hasn't spoken before quietly asks, "Do you speak German?"
"Yes, some. I've been in here 3 years."
"And you speak many other languages, we have heard. And yet you are Czechoslovakian." Silke doesn't protest, frowning, not understanding the significance. She had been taught languages at school, picked others up by being in here. The men all exchange looks.
Speaking other languages would have us believe you are a spy, here to report back to whoever will buy your information. This will be investigated in Krakow.
You can expect a long sentence of hard labour, the original officer says.
It takes Silke a moment to react, and then she is grabbed by the arm by the soldier who brought her into the room, dragged away, screaming her innocence.
I was forced! I was raped! No! Please!
But the soldiers do not react. They do not seem to hear. They are moving on to the next person. Montelupich Prison, Krakow, July 1945. Silke crouches in the corner of a damp, stinking cell. She struggles to register time passing. Days, weeks, months. She does not make conversation with the women around her. Anyone overheard speaking by the guards is taken out and brought back with bruises and torn clothing. Stay quiet, stay small, she tells herself, until you know what is happening and what the right things are to say or do. She has torn off a section of her dress to tie around her nose and mouth, in an attempt to minimise the stench of human waste, damp, and decay. One day they take her out of the cell. Faint from hunger and exhausted by the effort of vigilance, the figures of the guards and the wall and floors all seem immaterial, as in a dream. She stands in line behind other prisoners in a corridor, slowly moving towards a door. She can lean momentarily against a warm, dry wall. They keep the corridors heated for the guards, but not the cells themselves. And though the weather outside must be mild by now, the prison seems to trap cold from the night and hold on to it through the whole next day. When it is Silke's turn, she enters a room where an officer sits behind a desk, his face bathed in greenish light from a single lamp. The officers by the door indicate she should go over to the desk. The officer looks down at his piece of paper. Cecilia Klein. She glances around. She is alone in the room with three burly men. Yes? He looks down again and reads from the paper.
You are convicted of working with the enemy as a prostitute and additionally as a spy. You are sentenced to 15 years hard labour.
He signs the piece of paper.
You sign this to say you have understood.
Silke has understood all of the officer's words. He has been speaking in German rather than Russian. Is it a trick then? She thinks. She feels the eyes of the men at the door. She knows she has to do something. It seems she has no choice but to do the only thing in front of her. He flips the piece of paper and points to a dotted line. The letters above it are in Cyrillic, Russian script. Again, as she has experienced over and over in her young life, she finds herself with two choices. One, the narrow path opening up in front of her. The other, death. The officer hands her the pen and then looks towards the door, bored, waiting for the next person in line, just doing his job. With a shaking hand, Silke signs the piece of paper. It is only when she's taken from the prison and pushed onto a truck that she realises winter has gone, spring never existed, and it is summer. While the warmth of the sun is a balm to her chilled body, her still alive body, the glare of it hurts her eyes. Before she has a chance to adjust, the truck slams to a stop. There, in front of her, is another train carriage, on a cattle train, painted red. Chapter 2. A train bound for Vorkuta Gulag, Siberia, 160 kilometres north of the Arctic Circle, July 1945.
The floor of the closed railway wagon is covered in straw, and each prisoner tries to claim a small space on which to sit. Older women wail. Babies whimper. The sound of women suffering. Silke hoped she'd never have to hear it again. The train sits at the station for hours, the heat of the day turning the inside of the compartment into an oven. The bucket of water left to share is soon gone. The infants' cries turn wretched and dry. The old women are reduced to rocking themselves into a trance. Silke has placed herself against a wall and draws comfort from the small wisps of air that make their way through the tiny cracks. A woman leans on her from the side, and her back is shoved up hard against her raised knees. She leaves it there. No point fighting for space that doesn't exist. Silke senses that night has fallen as the train makes its first jolting movement, its engine struggling to pull the unknown number of carriages away from Krakow, away, it seems, from any hope of ever returning home. So she had allowed herself just one moment of hope, sitting in that block, back in that other place, waiting. She shouldn't have dared. She is destined to be punished. Maybe it is what she deserves. But as the train gathers speed, she vows she will never, ever end up in a place like Block 25 again. There must be more ways to stay alive than to be witness to so much death. Will she ever know if her friends who were forced to march out of the camp made it to safety? They had to. She can't bear to think otherwise. As the rhythm of the train rocks the children and babies to sleep, the silence is broken by the howl of a young mother holding an emaciated baby in her arms. The child has died. Silke wonders what the other women have done to end up here. Are they Jewish as well? The women in the prison mostly had not been, as she gleaned from overhearing various conversations. She wonders where they are going. By some miracle, she dozes. A sudden breaking of the train throws its passengers around. Heads bang, limbs are twisted, and their owners cry out in pain. Silke braces herself by holding on to the woman who has spent the night leaning into her. "We're here," someone says. But where is here? Silke hears train doors clanging open up ahead, but no one leaves their compartment. Their carriage door is flung open. Once again, brilliant sunshine stings Silke's eyes. Two men stand outside. One hands a bucket of water to grabbing hands. The second soldier tosses in several hunks of bread before slamming the door closed. Semi-darkness, once again, envelops them. A fight breaks out as the women scramble for a piece of the bread. A too familiar scene for Silke. The screaming intensifies until, finally, an older woman stands up, raising her hands, saying nothing, and even in the semi-darkness, the stance takes up the space and is powerful. Everyone shuts up. "We share," she says, with a voice of authority. "How many loaves do we have?" Five hands are raised, indicating the number of loaves of bread they have to share. "Give to the children first, and the rest we will share. If anyone doesn't get any, they will be the first to eat next time. Agreed?" The women with the bread begin breaking off small quantities, handing them to the mothers. Silke misses out. She feels upset. She does not know if it's the best idea to give the food to the children, if where they are going is like where she has been. It will only be wasted. She knows it is a terrible thought. For several hours, the train sits idle. The women and infants fall again into silence. The silence is broken by the screams of a girl. As those around her attempt to quieten the girl to find out what is wrong, she sobs, holding up a blood-covered hand. Silke can see it in the flickering light, coming through the gaps. "I'm dying!" The woman nearest her looks down at the blood staining her dress. "She has her period," she says. "She's all right, she's not dying." The girl continues sobbing.
The girl sitting at Silka's legs, a bit younger than her and wearing a similar summer dress, shifts to standing and calls out, "What's your name?"
"Anna,"
the girl whimpers.
"Anna?"
"I'm Josie. We will look after you," she says, looking around the compartment.
"Won't we?"
The women murmur and nod their assent. One of the women grasps the girl's face between her hands and brings it towards her own.
"Have you not had a monthly bleed before?"
The girl shakes her head. "No." The older woman clutches her to her breast, rocking her, soothing her. Silka experiences a strange pang of longing.
"You're not dying. You're becoming a woman."
Some of the women are already tearing pieces off their garments, ripping sections from the bottom of their dresses, and passing them along to the woman caring for the girl. The train jolts forward, dropping Josie to the floor. A small giggle escapes from her. Silka can't help but giggle too. They catch each other's eye. Josie looks a bit like her friend Geeta, dark brows and lashes, a small, pretty mouth. Many hours later, they stop again. Water and bread are thrown in. This time, the stop brings additional scrutiny, and the young mother is forced to hand over her dead infant to the soldiers. She has to be restrained from trying to leave the compartment to be with her dead child. The slamming of the door brings her silence as she is helped into a corner to grieve her loss. Silka sees how closely Josie watches it all, with her hand against her mouth.
"Josie, is it?"
Silka asks the girl who has been leaning against her since they first got on the train. She asks her in Polish, the language she has heard her using.
"Yes."
Josie slowly manoeuvres her way round so they are knee to knee.
"I'm Silka."
Their conversation opener seems to embolden other women. Silka hears others ask their neighbours their names, and soon the compartment is filled with whispered chatter. Languages are identified, and a shuffling takes place to put nationalities together. Stories are shared. One woman was accused of aiding the Nazis by allowing them to buy bread from her bakery in Poland. Another was arrested for translating German propaganda. Yet another was captured by the Nazis and, being caught with them, accused of spying for them. Amazingly, there are bursts of laughter, along with tears, as each woman shares how she ended up in this predicament. Some of the women confirm the train will be going to a labour camp, but they don't know where. Josie tells Silka that she is from Krakow and that she's 16 years old. Silka opens her mouth to share her own age and place of birth, but before she can, a woman nearby declares in a loud voice, "I know why she's here."
"Leave her alone,"
comes from the strong older woman who'd suggested sharing the bread.
"But I saw her dressed in a fur coat in the middle of winter while we were dying from the cold."
Silka remains silent. There's a creeping heat in her neck. She lifts her head and stares at her accuser, a stare the woman cannot match. She vaguely recognises her. Wasn't she, too, one of the old-timers in Birkenau? Did she not have a warm and comfortable job in the administration building?
"And you who wants to accuse her," says the older woman. "Why are you here in this luxurious carriage with us, going on a summer holiday?"
"I did nothing," comes the weak reply. "We all did nothing,"
Josie says strongly, defending her new friend. Silka clenches her jaw as she turns away from the woman. She can feel Josie's gentle, reassuring eyes on her face. Silka throws her a faint smile before turning her head to the wall, closing her eyes, trying to block the sudden memory flooding in of Schwarzhuber, the officer in charge of Birkenau, standing over her in that small room, loosening his belt, the sounds of women weeping beyond the wall. The next time the train stops, Silka gets her ration of bread. Instinctively, she eats half and tucks the rest into the top of her dress. She looks around, fearful someone might be watching and try to take it from her. She turns her face back to the wall, closing her eyes. Somehow, she sleeps. As she floats back awake, she is startled by Josie's presence right in front of her. Josie reaches out and touches Silka's close-cropped hair. Silka tries to resist the automatic urge to push her away.
I love your hair, the sad, tired voice says.
Relaxing, Silka reaches up and touches the younger girl's bluntly chopped hair.
I like yours too.
Silka had been freshly shaved and de-loused at the prison. For her, a familiar process, as she saw it happen so often to prisoners in that other place, but she supposes it is new for Josie. Desperate to change the subject, she asks,
Are you here with anyone?
I'm with my grandma. Silka follows Josie's eyes to the bold older woman who had spoken up earlier, still with an arm around the young girl, Anna. She is watching the two of them closely. They exchange a nod.
You might want to get closer to her, Silka says.
Where they are going, the older woman may not last long.
I should. She might be frightened.
You're right.
I am too, Silka says.
Really? You don't look frightened.
Oh, I am. If you want to talk again, I will be here.
Josie steps carefully over and around the other women between Silka and her grandmother. Silka looks on through the slats of light coming through the carriage. A small smile breaks free as she sees and feels the women shuffle and shift to accommodate her new friend.
It's been 9 days, I think. I've been counting. How much longer?
Josie murmurs to no one in particular. There is more room in the compartment now. Silka has kept count of how many have died, sick, starving or wounded from their prior interrogations, their bodies removed when the train stops for bread and water. 11 adults, 4 infants. Occasionally some fruit is thrown in with the dry husks of bread, which Silka has seen mothers soften in their own mouths for the children. Josie now lies curled up beside Silka, her head resting on Silka's lap. Her sleep is fitful. Silka knows of the images that must be racing through her mind. A few days ago, her grandmother died. She had seemed so strong and bold, but then she'd started coughing, worse and worse, and shaking, and then refusing her own ration of food. And then the coughing stopped. Silka watched Josie standing mutely at the compartment door as her grandmother's body was roughly handed down to the waiting guards. Silka experienced a physical pain so intense she doubled over, all her breath leaving her. But no sound and no tears would come. Auschwitz, 1942. Hundreds of girls are marched from Auschwitz to Birkenau on a hot summer day. 4 kilometres. A slow, painful march for many who have ill-fitting boots, or worse, no footwear. As they enter through the large, imposing brick archway, they see the construction of blocks. Men working there pause to stare in horror at the new arrivals. Silka and her sister Magda have been at Auschwitz for around 3 months, working among other Slovakian girls. They are turned from the main road through the camp and into a fenced-off area, with several buildings complete and others underway. They are stopped and held, standing in lines, as the sun beats down upon them for what seems like hours. From behind, they hear a commotion. Silka looks back to the entrance of the women's camp to see a senior officer, with an entourage of men following, walking up the row of girls. Most of the girls keep their heads down. Not Silka. She wants to see who warrants such protection from a group of unarmed, defenceless girls.
Obersturmführer Schwarzhuber, a guard says, greeting the senior officer. You'll be overseeing the selection today.
I will. The senior officer, Schwarzhuber, continues walking down the line of girls and women. He pauses briefly as he passes Silke and Magda. When he gets to the front of the row, he turns and walks back. This time, he can see the turned down faces. Occasionally, he uses his swagger stick, pushed under the chin, to raise the face of a girl. He is coming closer. He stops beside Silke, Magda behind her. He raises his stick. Silke beats him to it and lifts her chin high, looking directly at him. If she can get his attention, he will ignore her sister. He reaches down and lifts her left arm, appearing to look at the numbers fading on her skin. Silke hears Magda's sharp inhalation of breath behind her. Schwarzhuber drops her arm, walks back down to the front of the line, and Silke notices him speak to the SS officer beside him. They have been sorted, again. Left, right, hearts banging, bodies clenched in fear. Silke and Magda have been chosen to live another day. They're now in the line to be painfully marked again, to have their tattoos re-inked so they will never fade. They stand close, but not touching, though they desperately want to comfort each other. They whisper as they wait, consoling, wondering. Silke counts the number of girls in front of her. 5. It will soon be her turn, and then Magda's. Again, she will hand her left arm over to someone to have the blurred blue numbers punctured into her skin. First, she was marked on entering Auschwitz 3 months ago. Now, again, after being reselected for the new camp, Auschwitz II, Birkenau. She begins to shiver. It is summer. The sun blazes down on her. She fears the pain she will soon experience. The first time, she cried out in shock. This time, she tells herself she will remain silent. Though she is still only 16, she can no longer behave like a child. Peering out from the row of girls, she watches the tätowierer. He looks into the eyes of the girl whose arm he holds. She sees him place a finger to his lips and mouth, "Shh." He smiles at her. He looks down to the ground as the girl walks away, then looks up to watch her moving on. He takes the arm of the next girl in line and doesn't see that the previous girl turns back to look at him. 4, 3, 2, 1. It is now her turn. She glances quickly and reassuringly back at Magda, then moves forward. She stands in front of the tätowierer, her left arm by her side. He reaches down and gently lifts her arm up. She surprises herself by pulling it free, an almost unconscious reaction causing him to look at her, to look into her eyes, which she knows are filled with anger, disgust at having to be defiled again. "I'm sorry. I'm so sorry," he whispers gently to her. "Please, give me your arm." Moments pass. He makes no attempt to touch her. She raises her arm and offers it to him. "Thank you," he mouths. "It'll be over quickly." With blood dripping from her arm, though not as much as last time, Silke whispers, "Be gentle with my sister," before moving on as slowly as she can so Magda will be able to catch up. She looks curiously around for the girl who'd been in front of her. She glances back at the tätowierer. He has not watched her walk away. She sees the girl who'd been 5 in front of her standing outside Block 29 and joins her and the others waiting to be admitted into their home. She studies the girl. Even with her head shaven, the baggy dress hiding whatever curves she may have or once had, she is beautiful. Her large dark eyes show no signs of the despair Silke has seen in so many. She wants to get to know this girl who made the tätowierer stare. Soon, Magda joins her, wincing from the pain of the tattoo. They're temporarily out of sight of any guards and Silke clutches her sister's hand.
That evening, as the girls in Hut 29 each find a space in a bunk to share with several others and cautiously inquire to one another, "Where are you from?" Silke learns the girl's name is Gita. She comes from a village in Slovakia, not too far from Silke and Magda's town of Bardejov. Gita introduces Silke and Magda to her friends, Dana and Ivanka. The next day, following roll call, the girls are sent to their work area. Silke is pulled aside, not sent, like the others, to work in the Canada, where they sort out the belongings, jewellery and heirlooms brought to Auschwitz by the prisoners and prepare much of it for return to Germany. Instead, by special request, she is to report to the administration building, where she will work. Chapter 3. Vorkuta Gulag, Siberia. The temperature is dropping. It hasn't been sudden, more a gradual change noticed at night when Silke and the others have found themselves snuggling into each other. They are all in summer clothing. Silke doesn't know what month it is, though she guesses August or September, and she does not know where they are going, though the language at each stop is Russian. One day bleeds into the next. Illness creeps through the carriage. Pitiful coughing drains the women of what little energy they have. Conversations become fewer and shorter. At the last few stops, men had taken pity on the cargo, had stripped and thrown in their calzoni, as they called it, off their own bodies. Silke and Josie had pulled the loose, still warm undergarments up over their goose-bumped legs, waving a weak thank you. It has been 3 days since they last stopped, when the train screeches to a halt, the heavy doors flung back. A vast, unpopulated landscape of dirt and yellow-green grass lies before them. This time, it isn't one or two guards greeting them. Dozens of men in uniform, rifles at the ready, line the length of the train.
Navichod, they yell.
Get out! As the women struggle to their feet, many collapsing on legs no longer capable of bearing weight, the shouting continues. Silke and Josie join the others outside for the first time in weeks. They link arms with two older women who are struggling to stand. They don't need to be told what to do. With a line forming in front of them, they know which way to face. They can see some crude buildings in the distance, on the broad, flat plain. Another camp, thinks Silke, surrounded by nothingness. But the sky here is different, an impossibly vast grey-blue. They trudge along with the flow of the others towards the faraway buildings. Silke tries to count the number of carriages, some disgorging men, some women and children, people of all different ages, in varying states of ill health and distress. Some who'd been on the train since the beginning, some who'd been added along the way. Time stands still for Silke, as she remembers lining up to go into the other place. That line led to an existence that bore no end date. This time she knows her end date, should she survive to see it. 15 years. Will having an end date make the labour more endurable? Is an end date even to be believed? Before long, Silke is standing in front of a large woman dressed in a thick khaki uniform. Her own clothing is still too light for this weather. They must be far north. She can barely feel her hands and feet.
Imia, familia,
the woman barks at Silke, scanning a list on a clipboard. Name. Cecilia Klein. Her name ticked off. Silke follows the line into a large concrete bunker. Immediately she looks to the ceiling for the telltale signs of showers. Will it be water? Or gas? Her relief at not seeing anything threatening is palpable, and she holds on to Josie to steady herself.
Are you all right? Josie asks.
Yes, yes, I'm fine. I thought we might be going to have a shower.
I'd love a shower. It's what we need.
Silke forces a small smile. There does not seem any point in explaining what she had feared.
Looking at the bafflement on the faces around her, it dawns on her that few of them will have gone through something like this before. Only survivors from that other place, or those from other camps, carry the burden of knowing what may be in store for them all. As the room fills, several male guards enter.
Clothes off! Now!
Women look around for guidance. The words are whispered through in different languages, and they catch on as several slowly start removing their clothes. Silke whispers to Josie,
"You have to take your clothes off."
"No, Silke, I can't, not in front of men."
It seems Josie had only had her head shaved in prison, not the full ordeal. Silke knows that all the hair on their bodies will be shaved.
"Listen to me. You have to do as you're told."
Silke starts undoing the buttons on the front of Josie's dress. Josie pushes her hand away, confused, looking around at the other women in various stages of undress. The naked women hold their hands in front of their pubis and across their breasts. Slowly, Josie begins to undress.
"Hurry up," Silke says. "Just drop your clothes where they are."
Silke looks up at the men standing in front of the doors, yelling out instructions. The smirks and nudges between them sicken her. She looks down at the pile of her clothes at her feet. She knows she will not see them again. The men in front of the doors part as four other guards enter, each dragging with them a large hose. The blast of freezing water sends the women crashing into each other, screaming, shouting as they are knocked down, bundled together by the force of the water. The smell of chlorine becomes overpowering and the screaming changes to gagging and coughing. Silke is smashed up against a cracked tiled wall, grazing her arm as she slides to the ground. She watches as, sadistically, the guards target older, frail women who attempt defiance by trying to stand firm. They go down fighting. Silke curls up in the fetal position and stays there until the hoses are turned off and the laughing guards leave. As the women pick themselves up and shuffle towards the door, several grab at a dripping article of clothing to cover themselves. They exit the building and are handed a thin grey towel to wrap around themselves. Barefoot on the gritty, cold ground, they walk to a nearby concrete building, identical to the one they have just left. Silke sees Josie in front of her and hurries to catch up.
"Will they give us new clothes now?" Josie asks.
Silke looks at Josie's drawn, desperate face. There is much worse to come, she thinks. Maybe, momentarily, she can cheer her.
"I hope so. Grey is not my colour."
Silke is pleased when Josie stifles a snigger. They are roughly pushed into four lines and screams of protest inside are heard by those waiting to enter. Several terrified women break from their line, scared by the screams ahead. They become game for the warders to fire at. The shots miss, but send the women scurrying back into line. A source of entertainment. She feels Josie trembling beside her. Silke and Josie enter the building and see what is happening to the women in front of them. Four men stand behind four chairs. Several strong, large women, also dressed in khaki uniforms, stand nearby. She watches as the woman in front of her approaches the chair and is forced to sit down. The woman's hair is roughly gathered together and swiftly cut close to her head with a large pair of scissors. Without missing a beat, the man exchanges the scissors for a shaving blade and scrapes it across the woman's scalp. Blood trickles down her face and back. One of the nearby women is yanked to her feet, turned around, and placed with one of her feet on the chair. Josie and Silke watch in horror as the man, with no sign of emotion or care, shaves her pubic area. As he lifts his head, indicating he is done, the female guard pushes the woman away and motions for Josie to come forward. Silke quickly moves over into the next line so she is next to be shaved. She can at least be beside Josie as this humiliation is played out. She has been through it all before. Together they walk to the chairs. Without instruction, they sit. Silke keeps her eyes on Josie as much as she can, wordlessly offering comfort, her heart aching as she sees tears falling helplessly down Josie's cheeks. She can tell this is the first time Josie has been subjected to anything this brutal. Their heads shaved, Josie is slow to stand, and the back of a female guard's hand slaps her across the face as she is pulled to her feet. Silke places her own foot on the chair and stares at the man in front of her. Her glare is met with a thin, toothless grin, and she knows she has made a mistake. As Silke and Josie walk away, grey towels their only cover, blood trickles down Silke's inner thigh, her punishment for daring to be brave. Josie begins to vomit. Gagging, bile and watery liquid is all she can throw up. They follow others down a long corridor. "What next?" Josie sobs. "I don't know. Whatever it is, don't argue. Don't fight with them. Try to be invisible and do as you are told." "That's your advice. Just take it. Whatever it is, take it." Her voice rises, anger replacing shame. "Josie, I've been here before. Trust me." Silke sighs, but she also feels relief at Josie's display of strength and defiance. She will need that fire in a place like this. "Does this have something to do with the numbers on your arm?" Josie asks. Silke looks at her left arm, which is holding the towel across her body, tattoo exposed for all to see. "Yes, but don't ever ask me about that again." "All right," Josie says. "I trust you. At least no one is screaming ahead of us now, so it can't be so bad, right?" "Let's hope it's getting something warm to wear. I'm frozen. I can't feel my feet." Silke tries to bring lightness to her tone. As they approach a room at the end of the corridor, they see piles of grey towels dropped at the entrance. Once again, blank-faced female guards stand nearby. Ahead of them, they hear male voices.
"Timaya,
you are mine," Silke hears a guard call to one of the women just ahead of them in the queue. The woman behind her, older, shuffles forward. Silke and Josie are coming up to their turn.
"Move on, you old hag,"
a guard shouts at the woman. Silke's heart thumps. What is happening?
"Hey, Boris, what are you waiting for?"
"I'll know when I see her."
The woman in front of Silke turns back to the younger girls with a look of pity, whispering, "The bastards are picking who they want to fuck." She looks Silke and Josie up and down. "You'll have no problem." "What does she mean, we'll be picked?" Josie asks. Silke shakes her head in disbelief. Can this be happening again? She turns to Josie, looks her in the eyes. "Listen to me, Josie. If one of the men chooses you, go with him."
"Why? What does he want?"
"He wants your body." She hopes she will be able to explain to Josie later that he can have her body and that is all. He cannot have her mind, her heart, her soul.
"No. No, I've never been with a boy. Silke, please don't make me. I'd rather die."
"No, you wouldn't. You have to live. We have to live. Do you hear me? Do you understand?"
"No, I don't understand. I didn't do anything. I shouldn't be here."
"I'm sure most of us shouldn't be here, but we are. If you get chosen to be the property of just one man, the others will leave you alone. Now do you understand me?" Josie's face is tight, puzzled.
I think so." "Oh, Silke, this has happened to you before, hasn't it?"
"Lift your head up. Don't look afraid.
A moment ago you told me to be invisible."
"That was then. This is now. That's how quickly things can change." Silke raises her own eyes towards the men.
Birkenau Administration Block, 1942.
Silke is sitting beside Geeta, each working diligently, their eyes meeting fleetingly, small smiles shared. Silke was pulled out of the selection line and chosen for this work rather than the Canada, and she is grateful Geeta is now working here too. But she hopes she can also get Magda into the warmth, somehow. Geeta's hair is still cropped close to her head, but for some reason Silke has been allowed to grow hers. It feathers down over her neck and ears. She doesn't see the two SS officers approach them, and with no warning she is grabbed by the arm, jerked to her feet. As she is dragged away, she looks back at Geeta, her eyes pleading. Every time they are separated, it could be the last time they see each other. She sees an officer approach Geeta and strike her across the head with her hand. She tries to resist as she is dragged outside and across to the women's camp. She is no match for the two men. It is quiet in the camp, the women all out at work. They walk past the barracks where the women live until they come to an identical building, but this one is surrounded by a brick wall. Silke feels bile rise in her throat. She has heard that this is where women go to die.
"No, please," she says. "What's happening?"
There is a shiny car parked on the dirt road outside. The officers open the gate and go into the courtyard. One of the officers knocks loudly on the door to the left-hand building, and as the door opens, they throw her inside, slamming it behind her. Silke is sprawled on a rough dirt floor, and standing in front of her, in front of rows of empty, crude wooden bunks, is the man she recognizes from the selection, the senior officer, Schwarzhuber. He is an imposing man and is rarely seen in the camp. He taps his tall leather boot with his swagger stick. From an expressionless face, he stares above Silke's head. She backs up against the door, feeling for the door handle. In a flash, the swagger stick is hurled through the air and strikes her hand. She cries out in pain as she slides down to the floor. Schwarzhuber walks to her and picks up his stick. He stands over her, dwarfing her. He breathes heavily as he glares at her. "This will be your new home," he says. "Stand up." She gets to her feet. "Follow me." He takes her behind a wall where there is a small room and an individual wooden slatted bed with a mattress on it. "You know each block has a block leader," he says. "Well, you are to be the leader of block 25. Silke has no words, no breath. How could she, how could anybody be expected to be the leader of this block? This is the block where women spend their final hours before being sent to the gas chamber. And will she ever see Magda, see Geeta again? This is the most terrifying moment of her life. "You are very lucky," Schwarzhuber says. Taking off his hat, he throws it across the room. With his other hand, he continues to hit his leg firmly with his stick. With every whack, Silke flinches, expecting to be struck. He uses the stick to push up her shirt. "Oh," Silke thinks. "So this is why." With shaking hands, she undoes the top two buttons. He then places his stick under her chin. His eyes seem to see nothing. He is a man whose soul has died and whose body is waiting to catch up with it. He holds out both his arms, and Silke interprets this gesture as, "Undress me." Taking a step closer, still at arm's length, she begins undoing the many buttons on his jacket. A whack across her back hurries her up. He is forced to drop his stick so she can slide his jacket off. Taking it from her, he throws it after his hat. He removes his own singlet. Slowly, Silke begins undoing his belt and the buttons beneath it. Kneeling down, she pulls his boots off from over his breeches. Pulling the second one off, she becomes unbalanced, falling heavily on the bed as he pushes her. He straddles her. Terrified, Silke attempts to cover herself as he tears her shirt open. She feels the back of his hand across her face as she closes her eyes and gives in to the inevitable.
They're the trusties, a guard with a cigarette clenched between her teeth whispers. The voice brings Silke back to the present.
What?
The men you're about to be paraded in front of. They're the trustees, senior prisoners who have high positions in the camp.
Oh, not soldiers?
No, prisoners like you, who have been here a long time and work in the skilled jobs with the administrators. But these ones are also of the criminal class. They have their own network of power.
Silke understands.
A hierarchy between old and new. She steps into the room, Josie behind her, both of them naked and shivering. She pauses to take in the rows of men she must walk between. Dozens of eyes look back at her. The man first in line on her right takes a step forward and she turns to meet his stare, boldly sizing him up, making the judgment he would have been the leader of a gang wherever he came from. Not much taller than her, stocky, clearly not starving. She thinks he must not be much older than in his late 20s, early 30s. She examines his face, looking beyond the body language he's throwing her way. His face betrays him. Sad eyes. For some reason, she is not afraid of him.
"At last," is shouted out somewhere amongst the men. "About bloody time, Boris."
Boris puts his hand out to Silke. She doesn't take it, but moves closer to him. Turning back, she encourages Josie to walk on.
"Come here, little one," another man says. Silke looks at the man ogling Josie. A large brute, but hunched. His tongue darts in and out of his mouth, revealing badly coloured and broken teeth. He has more of a feral energy than Boris. And Josie is chosen. Silke looks at the man identified as Boris.
"What is your name?" he asks.
"Silke."
"Go and get some clothes and I'll find you when I need you."
Silke continues down the row of men. They all smile at her, with several making comments about her skin, her body. She catches up with Josie and they find themselves outside again, being ushered into another concrete bunker. At last, clothing is thrust at them. A shirt with missing buttons, trousers in the roughest fabric Silke has ever felt, a heavy coat and a hat. All grey. The knee-high boots, several sizes too big, will come in handy once she's wrapped her feet in whatever rag she can get to help with the cold. Dressed, they leave the bunker. Silke shades her eyes from the glare of sunlight. She takes in the camp resembling a town. There are clearly barracks for sleeping, but they are not neatly lined up like those in Birkenau. They differ in size and shape. Beyond the perimeter, she sees a small hill with a large crane-like piece of equipment rearing above it. The fence enclosing them is scattered with lookouts, nowhere near as threatening as she has experienced in the past. Silke looks closely at the top of the fence. She does not see the telltale insulators that would indicate it is electrified. Looking beyond the fence, to the barren, desolate terrain stretching as far as the horizon, she accepts no electric fence would be needed. There could be no survival out there. As they trudge towards the buildings that will become home, following the person in front, unaware who is leading them or directing them, a woman with a broad, weathered face sidles up to them. The sun might be attempting to shine, but the wind chill bites into any exposed skin. They are so far north that even though it is late summer, there is snow on the ground. The woman is wearing layers of coats, strong-looking boots, and has her hat pulled down and tied beneath her chin. She leers at Silke and Josie. "Well, aren't you the lucky ones? Got yourselves men to protect you, I hear."
Silke puts her head down, not wanting to engage in or encourage conversation with her. She doesn't see the leg extended in front of her, tripping her, so that with her hands in her pockets, she falls flat on her face.
Josie reaches down to help her up, only to be hit in the back and sent sprawling herself. The two girls lie on the damp, frosty ground, side by side.
Your looks won't get you anywhere with me. Now get moving!
Silke pulls herself up first. Josie stays lying on the ground, eventually taking Silke's hand as she is helped to her feet. Silke risks looking around. Amongst the hundreds of women, dressed the same, head shaven, faces buried in coats, it is impossible to identify the others from their train carriage. As they enter a hut, they are counted off by the gruff woman. Silke had thought maybe she was a guard, but she's not in uniform, and as she walks past her, Silke notices the number sewn on her coat and hat. Must be like a block leader, Silke thinks. The room has single beds lining one side, a space in the middle with a stove throwing out a version of heat. The women ahead of them have run to the stove and push and shove, hands extended towards it.
I'm your brigadier and you belong to me, the leader says. My name is Antonina Karpovna. Antonina Karpovna, she repeats slowly, pointing at herself so no one can misinterpret her meaning. All right, you lucky Zechkas. I hope you realize you have one of the best prisoner huts in the camp.
Silke thinks she must be right. No bunks, actual mattresses. A blanket each.
I'll leave you to sort yourselves out, the brigadier says with a wry grin before departing the hut.
What's a Zechka? Josie whispers.
I don't know, but it can't be a good word, Silke shrugs. Probably means prisoner or something like that. Silke looks around her. None of the beds have been claimed. The women ahead of them ran straight to the stove. Grabbing Josie's arm, Silke pulls her away to the far end of the hut.
Wait, let's find beds first. Sit on this one.
Silke claims the end bed, pushing Josie onto the one next to it. They both examine what they are sitting on. A thin grey blanket over an off-white sheet covering a sawdust-filled mattress. Their rush to find somewhere to sleep doesn't go unnoticed by the other women, who now also scramble for beds, pushing and shoving each other as they too claim the place they will sleep tonight, and for however many more nights they survive. It becomes obvious there is a bed for everyone. Hats are taken off and placed where a pillow would be, had one been provided. Silke glances to the space across from the end of their beds. Two empty buckets look back at her. Toilets. She sighs. For as long as she remains in this hut, she will be reminded of her greed to secure what she considered the best place to sleep. She thought she would have a little privacy. A wall on one side of her, Josie on the other. There's always a catch to a good position. To comfort. She should know that by now. Having established their place, Silke nudges Josie and they move towards the stove, hands outstretched. Silke senses she has made some enemies already. On day one. Josie is shoved in the back by a large, tough-looking woman, her age indeterminate. She sprawls forward, smashing her face on the hard wooden floor. Blood seeps from her nose. Silke helps Josie to her feet, pulling the girl's shirt up to her face, covering her nose, staunching the blood.
What did you do that for? A voice asks. Watch it, bitch, or you'll get the same, the bully says, getting in the other girl's face.
The other women observe the exchange. Silke wants to react, to defend Josie, but she still needs to know more about how the place works and who these women are, whether there's a possibility of them all getting along.
It's all right, Josie splutters to the girl who defended her, a young, slight woman with fair skin and blue eyes. Thank you.
Are you all right?
The girl asks, in Russian-accented Polish. She keeps touching her own shaved head.
She will be, Silke answers.
The girl examines Josie's face with concern.
I'm Natalia.
Josie and Silke introduce themselves.
You are Russian? Josie asks.
Yes, but my family was living in Poland for many decades. Only now they decide that is criminal.
She lowers her head for a moment.
And you?
Joseph's face crumples. They wanted to know where my brothers were, and they wouldn't believe me when I told them I didn't know. Silke makes soothing sounds to Josie.
I'm sorry, Natalia says. Perhaps let's not talk about it now.
Or ever, the bully says from her bed, turned away from the rest of them. It's all just variations on the same sob story. Whether we did something or not, we've been branded enemies of the state, and we are here to be corrected through labour.
She stays facing away from them, sighs. The fire crackles in the stove.
Now what?
Someone asks. No one is prepared to suggest an answer. Some of the women wander back to their chosen beds and curl up, going deep into their own silent thoughts. Silke takes Josie by the arm and leads her to her bed. Pulling the blanket back, she urges the girl to take off her shoes and lie down. Her nose has stopped bleeding. Silke goes back to the stove. Natalia is carefully placing more coal from a nearby bucket into the red-hot cavity, using the end of her coat to open and close the door. Silke looks at the coal pile. There's not enough to get us through the night, she says, as much to herself as to Natalia.
I'll ask for more, Natalia says in a softly spoken whisper.
She is rosy-cheeked and delicate-limbed, but looks strong. Silke can see in her eyes she thinks everything is going to work out. Silke knows how quickly that feeling can be taken away.
We could perhaps just watch and see what they do. Ask for nothing and you lessen the risk of a beating.
Surely they won't let us freeze, Natalia says, hands on hips.
The whisper is gone.
Several other women push themselves up onto an elbow in the beds where they lie, listening to the conversation.
Silke takes a moment to look around at all the faces now turned to her. She can't accurately tell all the women's ages, but thinks she and Josie are amongst the youngest. She remembers her own words, spoken only a matter of hours ago. Don't stand out. Be invisible.
Well, is thrown at her from the bully at the front of the hut.
All eyes are on her.
I don't know anything more than you. I'm just guessing. But I think we should go easy on what coal we have left in case we don't get any more today.
Makes sense, says another woman, who lies back down and turns her head away. Silke slowly walks back to the end of the hut, to her bed. The small drop in temperature from the middle of the room to the end, only a matter of a few metres, has Silke rethinking the decision she made in placing perceived privacy over warmth. She checks Josie, who appears to be asleep, before lying down. The sunlight goes on and on. Silke has no idea what time it is. She watches as Natalia approaches the fire, which is cooling, throwing a small amount of coal into the stove. Funny how people naturally fall into roles. She falls asleep at some point, while it is still light, or light again, she's not sure. Silke is startled awake by the loud clanging outside. The door to the hut opens, and the brigadier, Antonina Karpovna, is back.
Up and get out, Zechkas, she gestures with her head, her hands staying firmly entrenched in the pockets of her coat.
Silke knows the drill. She is the first to stand but doesn't move, hoping those at the front of the hut will leave first. She knows that standing somewhere in the middle is the safest place to be. She helps a drugged-looking Josie to her feet and pulls the blankets up on their beds. Pushing her way forward, she guides Josie along with her and out of the building. They see others like them exiting the huts all around.
Where were they when we arrived?
The women from Silke's hut huddle together outside in a ramshackle manner until they observe orderly rows of women walking around them. Copying, they form into two rows of 10. With the hut empty, they follow the lead of the others, slushing through thick mud towards a larger building. The rough fabric of her new clothes is chafing Silke's skin. Mosquitoes bite at her exposed neck. She notices the stairs,
both sorrowful and threatening. She understands. Another hut filled with inmates, more mouths to feed, more people to fight with for the better jobs. It is the newest arrivals who will have the hardest time adjusting and finding their place in the pecking order, until they are no longer the newest arrivals. She had been a long-timer in that other place, her and the other surviving Slovakian girls. They had seen it all. They had stayed alive. She wonders if she can find a way to advance her status and Josie's without standing out. Or maybe she is here because of thoughts like that. Maybe hard labour is what she deserves. They enter the mess building, observing the established tradition of lining up, accepting what is given to you, finding a bench to sit on. Eyes down, don't stand out. A tin mug is thrust into her hand. She checks on Josie. Her nose is swollen, bruising beginning to appear. Shuffling along, something resembling soup, full of little white, unidentifiable bits, is slopped into the mug. A chunk of stale bread thrust at her. Josie's hands shake and she spills half her food in her attempt to grab it. Soup and bread lie on the floor. Slowly, Josie bends down and picks up the bread. Silke has a horrible urge to yell at her. How much these small portions are worth? There are not enough tables and benches for all to sit. Many women stand around the walls looking, waiting for someone to finish and vacate their seat. Several eat while they stand, too hungry to care about table manners. One of the women from Silke's hut sees a space being vacated and hurries to reach it. She is met with a backhand from the person sitting next to the vacated spot, sending her mug flying, its contents splattering over both the floor and nearby diners.
Wait your turn, Novichok! You haven't earned the right to sit with us!
The pecking order is on display for the newcomers to observe and learn, just like in Birkenau, with the swarms of new arrivals. She and Gita and the other Slovakian girls had dwindled from thousands, having lost all of their friends and families. And the new ones didn't understand. Couldn't understand what their bodies and minds had been through, what they had done in order to survive. Eat your soup, then have your bread or save it for later, Silke says to Josie. Sometimes it is better to save it, just like we did on the train, until we know how often and how much we are going to be fed. She can see from looking at some of the women's sunken faces that it won't be frequent or nutritious. The two girls slowly sip the brown liquid. At least it is hot. There is no real substance to it. Josie notices others sitting at the table with spoons, scooping out what look like bits of potato, or possibly fish.
They didn't give us a spoon.
I think that might be something we have to obtain for ourselves, says Silke, seeing the beat-up-looking utensils some of the old-timers are using. When and however we can. Soon, Silke and the other newcomers are gathered by their brigadier. Antonina Karpovna corrals the women together and leads them back to their hut. As the last woman enters the room, Antonina watches them wander either to their bed or to the stove in order to be comfortable.
In future, when I enter the room, you will immediately go and stand at the end of your bed. Do I make myself clear?
Women jump from their bed or scurry to it, and all stand to attention at the foot.
You will also turn and face me. I will give instructions once only, and I want to look into your eyes and know you have all understood. Who understands what I am saying?
Several hands meekly rise, including Silke's. The rest had seemingly just followed what the other women were doing.
Then those who understand better teach the rest. Quickly.
She pauses to watch the women look to the person standing next to them, and a few of them pass on what had been said, mostly in other Slavic languages.
These are the rules you will live by while you are here. We have already determined when and how you will work, receive food,
and how long you will sleep. Lights will go out at 9 p.m, though in summer you won't really notice. Between now and then is when you will clean the floor in here, restock the coal for the next day, shovel any snow away from the front of the building, do any mending of your clothes, whatever is required for you to live here. I will not stand for this place looking like a pigsty. I want to be able to eat off the floor. Do you hear me? You will hear the wake-up call. You won't be able to sleep through it. Two of you will empty the toilet buckets. I don't care who does it. Just make sure it is done. No one will eat until it is.
Not a word is spoken, but all heads nod.
If you fail to do any of this, but especially if you fail to do your share of work, letting down my brigade, you'll be thrown in the hole. She sniffs. The hole is a solitary confinement cell in the Lagpunkt. It is a dank, mouldy place where your body is forced into a crooked shape whether you stand, sit, or lie down. There is no stove, and through a barred open window, the snow will come in on you from outside. You'll be lucky to get a bucket for your waste, as there's a ready-made stinking hole in the floor. You will receive barely a third of your normal ration and a black, hard piece of bread at that. Do you understand?
The heads nod again. A shiver runs down Silka's spine. From a bag draped over her shoulder, Antonina produces strips of rag and a crumpled piece of paper from her pocket.
When I call your name, come and get your number. You have two. One you must put on your hat, the other on whatever outer garment you wear. You must never be seen outside without your number visible on at least one garment.
As names are called out, the women respond and take the two rags handed to them, examining the number roughly written in paint.
Another number.
Silka subconsciously rubs her left arm. Hidden under her clothing is her identity from that other place. How many times can one person be reduced, erased? When her name is called, she takes the fabric handed to her and examines her new identity. 1-B494. Josie shows Silka hers. 1-B490.
Sew the numbers on, and do it tonight, all of you. I want to see them all in the morning.
She pauses, lets the translations come through, looks at the confused stares.
I expect to see some interesting needlework. It will tell me a lot about you, she sneers.
A brave voice pipes up.
What do we use for needle and thread?
From her bag, the brigadier produces a small piece of fabric with two needles punched through. They look like they've been fashioned from wire and sharpened to a point. She hands them to the nearest woman.
So, get to it. I'll be back in the morning. Tomorrow, you work. 6 o'clock wake up.
Excuse me, says Natalia. Where do we get coal from?
Work it out for yourselves.
As the door shuts behind her, the women gather around the stove. Silka is relieved no one received a beating for their questions. Josie offers,
If we go outside, we might see the others getting their coal. Then we'll know where to go.
Knock yourselves out, says the bully, Elena, lying back on her bed. This could be our last day off.
I'll come with you, says Silka.
Me too, says Natalia. The rest of you start sewing.
Yes, master, says Elena coldly.
Josie has placed the remaining few pieces of coal beside the stove and picks up the empty bucket. The three of them cautiously leave the hut, looking around. Darkness is closing in, and searchlights light the yard. It is cold. They can see prisoners darting here and there between buildings and a group of young women walking quickly towards the hut near them, carrying buckets brimming with coal.
This way, says Silka.
Natalia steps in front of the women.
Can you tell us where the coal is, please?
Find it yourself, is the reply.
Natalia rolls her eyes.
They came from here, Josie says, pointing to a building. From behind there somewhere. Let's go and look.
They arrive back in the hut after taking turns carrying the heavy bucket. Natalia goes to place it on the floor. Her soft hands slip from the handle, the coal spilling on the floor. She looks at the other women, apologising.
It's all right, I'll sweep up, volunteers Josie.
Two women are quickly sewing their numbers to their hat and coat.
Where did you get the thread from?
Natalia asks before Silke gets the chance.
From our sheets, says the older woman, speaking a halting Slavic, close to Slovak, and repeating it in Russian.
Possibly the oldest in the hut, a lifetime of hard work and making do evident in her abrupt words. She tells them her name is Olga. Silke looks around and sees other women carefully stripping away thread from the end of their sheets.
Hurry up! What are you doing taking so long with the needle, Olga?
Elena asks, looming over the older woman.
I'm trying to do a good job. If you do it properly the first time, you won't have to do it again. Give me the needle now, you stupid bitch! There's a time and place to show off your embroidery skills, and it's not here!
Elena reaches out her hand, impatiently.
I'm nearly there, Olga says calmly.
Silke admires the way she's dealing with the hot-tempered Elena, but she also understands the urge to lash out when all is not going as planned. This must be Elena's first camp. Olga increases her sewing speed, snapping off the end of the thread with her teeth before handing the needle over.
Here you go. Tuk krava.
Silke suppresses a grin. Olga has just called Elena a fat cow in Slovak, in an endearing voice. She winks at Silke.
My father was Slovakian, she says.
Elena scowls, snatching the needle. Silke sits on her bed, looking at Josie, who forlornly fiddles with her number patches. She seems to go from capable to overwhelmed in a matter of moments.
Hand it over, she says.
Josie looks pained.
One day at a time, Silke says. All right?
Josie nods. Silke starts stripping threads from her sheet. When a needle is handed to her, she quickly sews the numbers on Josie's and her own garments. Each time she stabs the needle through the fabric, she feels the pain of a needle stabbing into her left arm. Another number. Another place. She grimaces. To have lost everything. To have had to endure what she has endured and be punished for it. Suddenly the needle feels as heavy as a brick. How can she go on? How can she work for a new enemy? Live to see the women around her tire, starve, diminish. Die. But she... she will live. She does not know why she has always been sure of that, why she feels she can persist, keep picking up this needle even though it's as heavy as a brick, keep sewing, keep doing what she has to do. But she can. She starts to feel angry, furious, and the needle feels light again, light and quick.
It is this fire, then, that keeps her going. But it is also a curse. It makes her stand out, be singled out. She must contain it, control it, direct it. To survive.